5, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 541, and Senator Frank Morse and Bruce Goldberg, do you want to come forward? And Jody, I don't have the list. So Jody, yes, okay.
That's okay. Who's gonna get quiet down here?
Okay. Kathy Britton, can you hear us? Well, we can't hear you, Kathy. Kathy, we can't hear you, but if you can hear us, we're going to start with the testimony. Okay, we see you nodding, so that's good. All right, Senator Frank Morse, will you please start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. Accompanying me at the table this afternoon is Dr. Jody Pettit and Dr. Bruce Goldberg. The focus of this bill, Senate Bill 541, is a part of the larger picture of managing cost increases and increasing quality assurances for patients. And I would like to, by way of opening, just reference some information that came from the executive summary of the subcommittee of the Health Policy Commission on electronic health records. Although the United States has one of the most technologically advanced healthcare systems in the world, it relies predominantly on a 19th century record-keeping system. This antiquated paper-based record-keeping system and the barriers it imposes on appropriate data sharing is a source of harm and excess cost to Oregonians. The state of Oregon can assist substantially in transformation of the system by adopting electronic health records and health information exchange. Madam Chair, what I would like to do is, in terms of our presentation, I know your schedule is full today, would be to ask Dr. Pettit to address more of why this bill is important, and then Dr. Goldberg to address specifically what the bill will accomplish. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Pettit.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Jody Pettit. I'm a practicing internal medicine physician and on the faculty of the Providence Portland Medical Center Internal Medicine Residency. I've been fortunate to chair the Electronic Health Records and Healthcare Connectivity Subcommittee. I'm also a project director of the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation for a working group called Oregon Health Information Infrastructure, and I'm on the adjunct faculty at OHSU in their clinical, their Department of Medical Informatics and Clinical Epidemiology. I'd like to start just to illustrate some of the issues that we want to talk about today. A clinical vignette, and I think this really helps to illustrate some of the problems. Not too long ago, I saw a woman in clinic who came in with a persistent cough. And we had tried several treatment regimens, but her cough continued. We ultimately ordered a chest x-ray, and it showed a lesion in her right lung. She'd had a chest x-ray several years prior and remembered that there was something abnormal, but she couldn't remember exactly what that was. So we requested the information or the records from another institution, and then we waited. And we waited. And we waited until we felt like we finally couldn't wait any longer. The old chest x-ray would be of great value, because if you see that the lesion existed 4 or 5 years ago, then we could watch it and we wouldn't have to worry as much about it. But instead, in a situation where there's a lack of information flow, we end up repeating the test or even escalating the test to a CT scan, which is what this woman got in this case. A chest CT costs a little less than $1,000. in this story, the old film finally did make it, and in fact, this woman had this lesion existing for several years, and in fact, we could have saved her the worry, the time, the money, and reassured her right then and there. This story is not some bizarre exception or rare occurrence. This happens every time we go to clinic, and the reason that this is so important is because this lack of information flow has an impact on all of us. The Electronic Health Records and Healthcare Connectivity Subcommittee that met under the Oregon Health Policy Commission came up with a set of recommendations, and thanks to Senator Morris and others, they've mirrored those recommendations in this Senate bill. One of the ultimate goals here is to foster the use of electronic health records and to provide secure connectivity so that a person's health information is available to them anytime, anywhere that it's needed for their care. Senate Bill 541 will help establish a strong leadership position in the state to help coordinate efforts. It will also help establish a public-private partnership, and some of these ties have already been established, but they're running on really volunteer efforts, and we need to continue to move this forward. The Senate bill also authorizes a pilot project, and finally, it makes our state more attractive for federal funding. With a state-sanctioned effort, it shows commitment to this effort. Without good coordination, what will happen is that we will actually increase or at least maintain the fragmentation that exists in our system now. And good coordination can help in a number of ways. We have hospital systems that have worked really hard, and we have some exemplary systems in this state, and they're well integrated within their walls, but good coordination by the state could help us integrate in between health systems. We have several federally funded projects here in Oregon, but without coordination, they may use their federal money in disparate ways. We would like to see these groups working together to solve some of the same problems. Patients are going to be increasingly aware of the need for personal health records and access to their own electronic health records. In fact, a recent survey showed that 83% of respondents agreed that they would like to have access to their health information anytime, any place. So we believe that the public is going to be increasingly engaged in this, and coordination will help accomplish this sooner. And as far as electronic health record adoption, there are thousands of physicians out there that would like to get connected, but it's financially burdensome, and we believe that with coordination we could help these groups work together and perhaps share some overhead and accomplish this much sooner.
So we need to sum up now.
Yeah. Okay. I know I was at risk of going too long. So we believe that supporting Senate Bill 541 really will have that a small investment can really lead to a large payoff, and that ultimately it can move towards a lifelong virtual patient record.
Thank you. And could you address Dash 1, since that is what is going to be the bill? It's not the printed bill, correct? Just for the committee members.
Yes, that Madam Chair. The Dash 1 amendments will become the bill.
Okay. Dr. Goldberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office of Health Policy. You're used to me coming before you talking about the rising health care costs and the need to both make health care more affordable as well as to improve quality. And we've talked a lot about that, and indeed this bill puts forth what are one of the solutions to that. Establishing in the state a seamless electronic healthcare record and healthcare connectivity will be one of the ways and one of the strategies that we as a state can help provide more affordable care as well as to improve quality. What this bill will do is actually allow us to begin that journey forward in a real way. About a year ago, Senator,
can you just describe what it is? Is that, are you getting there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I will. Let me go right to that. This bill will establish within the Office of Health Policy and Research, and as well as within the Oregon Health Policy Commission, a task force on electronic medical records consisting of 15 members. And those members are outlined here. And there is a charge to the group to serve as an advisory committee to the Oregon Health Policy Commission to make recommendations for technical architecture that ensures the security and confidentiality of health data exchange, to make recommendations on the development of national standards, to make recommendations on ways to promote the use of electronic health records in the state, to convene and coordinate community-based health information exchange projects, to make recommendations on the most appropriate method to match a patient's identity across healthcare settings, to make recommendations on the formation of public and private partnerships, to help build the infrastructure and implement health information applications across the state, and in essence, to develop a coordinated regional framework for this. What this bill will do is establish an advisory committee as well as an individual who will be tasked with and have the expertise to help us as a state move this forward. This is an agenda that we're beginning to move to as a country, that all states are beginning to move to. And in essence, what this bill does is help establish a position, a champion, and an appropriate advisory committee, as well as the appropriate tie-in to the Health Policy Commission, as well as to the legislature, to be certain that if we do this, we do it in a way that's thoughtful, coordinated, and in conjunction with the bodies that we've established in the state to help oversee this. And in essence, that's what this bill does, is allow us to move this forward and hopefully to begin to establish the kind of partnerships, seek the support from federal sources and foundation sources to be able to move what is a very technical and can at times be an expensive agenda forward, but we feel this is a vehicle to begin to do that.
Just one question. Is there a fiscal on this that you're aware of? Is it going to be will the Health Policy Commission need more money to implement this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what this bill does, it asks the current budget, asks of the current budget to redirect funds. And Dr. Goldberg has mentioned that it may require, and we're going to do this, we'll explore it between now and Friday, if there may be an amendment to House Bill 3624 of last session. I did not feel that it was the time, given our budget constraints, to ask for additional general fund appropriations. But what I thought was it was appropriate to look at current allocations and look at redirecting those allocations. So we will have that information for you on Friday.
So at this point in time, it says it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but you're saying with the amendment and with more information, it may not have to go to Ways and Means, or?
Madam Chair, I would defer to leadership on the referral issue. I would love for it to just stay in policy because it does not have a fiscal impact. It would require possibly, by statute, amending previous policy that we've set in terms of direction of existing funds. So this bill does not ask for new money. It asks for redirection of existing allocations.
And is that within the department or the commission itself,
yeah,
not a line item that Ways and Means would need to address?
It's, Madam Chair, it's funding within the Office of Health Policy. And I've been working with Senator Morris at ways that we can creatively look to redirect some of the current budget and change some of the responsibilities of the office to put some efforts towards this. And I'm hopeful that we can work that out. And if we can, there would not be the need for any fiscal impact on this.
Senator Morse.
Well, thank you. Are you aware of the leapfrog? Yeah. Okay. My suggestion is that you put it in terms of money that you will seek grants, and implementation will maybe depend on rearranging the chairs within a department or seeking a federal grant or the leapfrog grant or whatever, because this is a very important program. Other states are doing it. It's a national priority, so there should be lots of support out there.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Moore said that the bill actually directs myself to go forth and indeed do that, to apply for and receive contributions and monies from the federal government and other private and public sources. So I think the idea behind this is to jumpstart something, allow us to actually go out and get the resources to go out and seek additional resources that we're going to need.
Yep. Senator George.
Madam Chair, I have two questions. A few years ago, I was serving on a county budget committee. We were talking about adding a GIS system in, and one of the commissioners and I looked at that and said, great idea, but why be the leader? Why don't you wait? We've waited about 3 years and bought that system for 5 cents on the dollar after they developed it. I see no provision, and that's my second question here, is I see no provision for us to actually, if we develop this, like on page 2, line 25, 26, and 27, if we build that infrastructure and that information system for us actually to be able to capitalize on it and franchise out like we've done on several other innovative projects. Is there any possibility for that to happen if we come up with technologies that we might be able to make a profit off of?
I don't feel qualified.
Is our technical expert here?
Madam Chair, Senator George, as you well know, I can turn on my computer and that's about it.
Yeah.
So to speak informatively about something as complex as this, I'm not capable of doing that. However, what I do understand is that what we need are standards of architecture that will create interoperability between discrete systems so that you can have transferability. And so if that is creating a product that has commercial value, I wouldn't have the foggiest idea.
Okay.
I defer to the experts.
Okay. All right. Well, we need to move on. Bruce Goldberg and Kathy Britton, do you have a word to say while Bruce is coming up?
Thank you, Terry Anderson. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. I'm glad we're set then. I will keep my statements very, very brief. For the record, my name is Catherine Britton. I am the chair of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon and also the telehealth representative to the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. Both of these organizations support the efforts outlined in this bill. We feel like because of the national pressure to do this, Oregon will have three choices. They can lead, they can follow, or they can get out of the way. And following and getting out of the way is probably not a way to develop a system that meets the needs of Oregon consumers and providers. So we feel like that taking the lead, taking an active lead on this will be in our best interest. The other thing is that's important is that this committee, this task force, is made up of people who are using health information on a daily basis. They know where it needs to go. They know how they want to receive it. They know the problems that can come with trying to transport it and can bring some very real-world, viable considerations to the table as this gets developed. In I think that we've learned that the best way to approach a problem of this magnitude is to bring everyone to the table. So you'll notice that the committee brings telecommunications providers, it brings insurers, it brings a wide variety of people who can answer the specific questions that are going to come up. This does not mean that there won't be some subcommittees that will have to come into play for specific issues, but it does bring the whole plethora of folks that need to be there to the table. I think that one of the things that is important in terms of the question that Senator George asked is that we're not creating a product. We're creating a means to make the products that are out there interoperable and to help develop a standard at a nationwide level for interoperability of those products. I don't know whether you're aware, but when video conferencing systems first came into play for healthcare, they were all built on separate algorithms, and all of a sudden, nobody could talk to each other. Those that were willing to move to standard survived. Those that weren't died. I think we can bring pressure to bear on the vendors that are developing healthcare information systems to make them interoperable and make them much easier for us to bring together and to synthesize into one state architecture. So in closing, I think it's real important that you consider the good that this bill could do, the good that this task force will do, and I think the approach of leading will position us to be a leader in at the national level, and we will be able to develop a system that is meaningful for Oregonians and is not what I fear will be a cookie-cutter approach coming out of the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. And I think you're speaking from Southern Oregon, correct?
Yes, I am. I'm at the Rogue Valley Medical Center in the Smullen Lecture Hall.
All right. Thank you so much. Bruce Gold.
You're welcome.
Bruce Bishop. the two of them. They both have sort of beard. Before he starts, let's, for the record, there's two letters committee that you received, one from Louis Machuca, who's a part of, from Cryptig, which is a leading healthcare IT company that's in support of this, as well as Duncan Wise, who is representing the Oregon Business Council Healthcare Task Force, is something he's part of. Bruce Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I am Bruce Bishop. Not to be confused with Dr. Goldberg, whose remarks I would like to endorse, along with Dr. Pettis, in support of the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 541. We appreciate Senator Morse's leadership in bringing this forward. It's an important issue for the Hospital Association and its members, and we support the bill as proposed to be amended. I think it's also fair to say that it's not without some anxiety about this, because some of our members have questioned whether the states getting involved in this will be a boon or a barrier to promoting systems that can talk to each other. And ultimately, we've concluded that this approach is necessary to get the parties to the table and to be coordinating. And so for that reason, we're supporting this effort, because we don't know of another way to make sure that the systems we develop are going to be successful and able to integrate. And that seems particularly important for patients. Patients aren't staying in one place forever, and they need to have the information available where they are. This will at least help us develop systems in Oregon and hopefully be prepared to adopt approaches that are going to be considered nationally as well. Finally, I'd like to add that our support of this bill does not necessarily constitute an endorsement of the orange and black ties that are being on the
building. But you like them.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. We will be having a work session on this bill in Bend, and I now will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 541. And that committee is this Friday in Bend. committee meeting.
And we expect you all to be there. No.
Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 675. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to talk today about an issue in which many of you have talked publicly about, particularly the Senate President, Senator Courtney, has talked very eloquently about. I can't match his eloquence, but maybe I can match his fervor for the importance of this issue. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 675. Childhood obesity is an epidemic in Oregon. 28% of Oregon's 8th graders and 21% of Oregon's 11th graders are obese. Over the last 20 years, the percentage of Oregon teenagers who are overweight has tripled. This is the result of poor nutritional choices, lack of physical activity, and a culture that encouraged these unhealthy habits. Obese children are also clearly at the risk of developing high blood pressure, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes, along with many other illnesses. The bill before you is just a first step in addressing this issue in a comprehensive fashion. You might note that in this bill that I've asked that if this bill is enacted for the Health Policy Commission to look at this issue. I did this for a number of reasons. Representative Cruz, who actually was the chief sponsor, I believe, of the legislation to create the Health Policy Commission. The Health Policy Commission was created to act as the primary advisory committee to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, to the governor, and to the legislature. And I thought that this issue is of such a magnitude that this should be an issue that they look at. When I look at the Health Policy Committee, and I'm a member of that committee, I look at it as having two different charges, but they're very connected. One is to look at health issues. Actual underlying health issues, long-term health issues. The other is to look at health care. They're in some way separate, but they are very much connected. This bill will help create a framework to reduce childhood obesity in our public schools and throughout our communities. Members, last fall, my staff and I spent many hours, many, many hours, researching many concepts for bills, and we spent many hours looking at the issue of childhood obesity. Sitting behind me and to my left is Caitlin Simmons, who probably spent more hours than she would ever want to researching childhood obesity and also pesticide use reporting. She is the one that actually spent many of those hours. We examined every issue that has come before this session. We examined mandatory physical education requirements. We examined nutritional requirements in schools. We looked at the issues of BMI testing. We looked at some of the issues around right choices type of education, getting young people to make the right choices in terms of their nutritional choices. We also looked at median health campaigns. We considered clearly every piece of legislation that has been introduced in this session, but we chose to take a slightly different approach. We even actually researched all of Oregon's current efforts relative to childhood obesity, and I'm sure many of you are aware that Oregon is one of the states that has been selected by the Center for Disease Control as part of their nutrition and physical activity program to prevent obesity and other chronic diseases. Oregon, in that claim, is classified as a blue state, indicating that we are in a capacity building stage. Health departments are gathering data, building partnerships, and creating statewide health plans. Critical groundwork before implementing nutritional and physical activity interventions. SB 675 allows these approaches to be incorporated into a comprehensive plan to address childhood obesity. We also looked at a number of other states. Some of them are very interesting. California has a fairly well-developed program that includes nutrition, obesity education, diabetes education, nutritional reform, nutritional content, standards in foods and beverages served on campus, and screening for type 2 diabetes and parental notification of at-risk children. Arkansas has BMI testing and actually has had some success with that and some problems with it. Then we came upon the state of New York. The state of New York has a wonderful system. It almost approaches that of Congress. We found the most beautiful piece of legislation on childhood obesity we have ever seen. It included practically every facet of trying to address this in a comprehensive approach imaginable. It had media and health campaigns, school and community nutritional education, government food assistance campaigns, conferences and program development, data collection and evaluation. What we found, though, was New York had a system much like Congress, where they have authorization and appropriation bills. The authorization bill passed by an overwhelming margin. Passed, I think, without a dissenting vote. Not a single dollar was ever appropriated to do anything that was in the bill.
We can do that.
What this bill attempts to do is to look at best practices and successful approaches with a comprehensive, involved strategy to combat childhood obesity. It is in no way meant to be a delay or a deterrent in passing any of the other legislation that is before this body. It just simply wants to take a very comprehensive look at this issue. To study the issue, the problem of childhood obesity, to develop a comprehensive strategy based on the findings to address childhood obesity. We're asking the Health Policy Commission to examine childhood obesity prevention programs, consider the recommendations of appropriate nutrition and physical education authorities, conduct discussions with local, state, federal officials regarding childhood obesity prevention options, to review existing childhood obesity prevention programs in this state, and to report its findings to the governor and to the 74th Legislative Assembly. Colleagues, I chose the Health Policy Commission for this purpose simply because this is one of the very reasons why it was set up. This is a major health issue. It has a very good structure in that committee. I will take myself away from that structure as not being maybe one of the most beneficial elements in that. But it has very involved people that understand the issues, and it also has clearly the capability to bring in numerous experts that even have more expertise in the area.
Senator Devlin, have you talked with Dr. Bruce Goldberg and the Health Policy?
Yes, I have. I actually presented at one of their meetings.
And what is their reaction to this bill?
Their reaction to the bill was, well, they never took a vote on the bill. Their reaction was I would say it was supportive. They were a little bit concerned about too many mandates coming from the legislature on issues, but I think they understood that the importance of this particular issue was high enough that they should at least comment on. One of the reasons I think I talked to the chair about this issue, one of the things that I'm looking for is not just, and I hate to use that expression, I'm not looking for just a rump discussion of childhood obesity issues. I'm not looking for people just to sit around a room and discuss what they think are the viable options. I'm actually looking for quantifiable research that's evidence-based that will help us put together a comprehensive program to address childhood obesity, and I know of no better group that we could put in that could give us a recommendation than the Health Policy Commission.
Okay.
And I specifically chose not to create a separate board because I thought that that's what they were created to do.
Okay. Good. We need to move quite fast. And Dr. Bruce Goldberg, do you want to make it? Okay. But Dr. Cohn, would you please come up while Senator Cruz asks
Senator
the question?
And you're right. This is the sort of issue that the commission was created for, but this bill does not. I mean, it requires them to do it, but it allows them to do it in their priority matrix. So,
right.
So I mean, it doesn't say you got to stop everything you're doing and do this. So
no,
they can do it. They can fit it into their book of business and do it in. So I think that's totally appropriate.
Dr. Cohn.
Please go ahead. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill. Most of the substantive issues about the importance of obesity, Senator Devlin's already alluded to. I'm not going to repeat those here. The one issue I want to address is the role that our physical activity and nutrition program might play with regard to this activity. I think many of you know that 2 years ago, in collaboration with a very large group of partners, we launched these two statewide plans. These were published in February of 2003, one for physical activity and one for nutrition. And I think these are a great starting point that will be of great use to the commission as they approach this issue. these are the bones. If you'll forgive me, perhaps an inappropriate analogy, we need to add a little flesh to the bones. And I think that the Health Policy Commission, within the resources that they have available, can help do that, help keep this issue on the radar screen, and continue to inform you all about what is really one of the leading public health issues that we're facing in the future. So that's
okay.
Basically what
we're
going
to do.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I would truly hope that the Commission would come to the legislature and make specific proposals if they feel that's the appropriate way to go. Because we keep coming back with solutions that are not passed for various reasons. And I think that you have to work with the local governments, the school districts, any agency that has a investment in this particular area, but to come back with not just a report, which we have a lot of, but specific suggestions about where we should be going on these issues, because we've talked it to death. We've been doing this ever since I've been in the building, and I'm looking for some action, so hopefully we'll get some next time at least. We're not going to get any this time.
Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson. Senator Devin, Dr. Cohen, childhood, define childhood for me, please.
Senator Courtney, I would probably leave that to Dr. Cohn, but I would normally define childhood as, and this is not a scientific, as anywhere between 0 and probably 13 in terms of childhood.
Then that's what
but
you think.
But childhood obesity is an issue even beyond that into middle school and high school.
I'm not trying to mess you up. I just think you should know that if you look at the legislation, you talk about 8th graders and 11th graders. All I'm asking is, for your own sake, in terms of what you want to do, very glorious, honorable, wonderful thing. Childhood, I don't know what age group you're talking about. In some other bills, they talk about different ages. And maybe it's not important, but for what it's worth, you might think about what age groups you're talking about. So, yeah. That's all. Thank you, Chairman Fantasy.
Okay, is there any other further discussion? Yes, Senator George.
Just a quick note that on the second page, line 1, number 4, it says the Commission may submit legislative measures for refiling. So, here's the bill with you. What's the bill to move forward with? Some ideas.
Yes, sir.
All right. No further discussion. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 675, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 675.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 675 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 675 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, yes. I think I'd just say I understand President Courtney's concern, but childhood obesity doesn't disappear as people get older, but it's still, I mean, it tracks, and so...
I'm evidence of that, Senator Courtney.
So I understand the concern, but I think that the language is general enough that we can target... We know who we need to target here, and the earlier we get them, the better off we are, so...
Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Before we call the roll.
Just a minute.
It seems to me there's a standard definition of 18 years of age for a lot of programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, if it's okay,
21.
Madam Chair. I believe that's true. The language that I think is being referenced is the language in the whereas. I mean, we're looking at childhood probably at all ages, but looking at where efforts could best be targeted. One of the realities in this, and I think that anyone that has worked in this area and tried to propose legislation, is trying to see both what a comprehensive program would be like and what incremental steps you could take to get there. And clearly that'll probably be the situation we're in the next biennium.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm 53 and I'm still in my first childhood. So.
Yes, we know.
We're proud of it.
Okay. Any other discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Monsanto?
Aye. Senator Devlin, motion carries. Senator Devlin?
I'm fine with the chair carrying it if she chooses to. She's one of the sponsors.
I will carry the bill. All right. Did I close it?
No.
I closed the work session of Senate Bill 675, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. And, Mr. Bacobian, would you bring us up to date on the amendment, which
Thank you, Chair. It's in your packet, and this came from the last hearing where Mr. State from the Office of Medical Assistance Programs recommended that the bill actually address families up to 10% of the federal poverty level because of the way the computer systems track within the department. It would be probably have a fiscal impact if we were to try to find folks up to 11%. So we do have the dash one amendments in your packet. It just changes the line that those no more than 10% of the federal poverty level would be exempt from the premiums. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I would like to, since there's no one to testify, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 825, and I would like, 824, and I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 824.
Madam Chair, I move the dash. Do we have a dash one? The dash one amendments to Senate Bill 824.
Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I would like to move Senate Bill 824 to the House. Is there a fiscal?
I think you better move it to the Senate.
To the Senate.
To the Ways and Means, right? Oh, it doesn't have.
Okay. I would like to move Senate Bill 824 to the
as amended
to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I'm going to be voting against this simply because I think it's a solution in search of a problem. I think there are unintended consequences that will happen here. When we put together the premium program several sessions ago with the help and support of Governor Kitzhaber, we did it for a very good reason, and to piecemeal take it apart, I'm not sure is appropriate.
Any other discussion? Yes. Okay, we have a letter from the Office of Medical Assistance Program, and maybe we should just take a look at that before we go forward. Does everyone want to bring that out? It says, based on the following recommendations to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs and to the legislature, there should be no premiums charged to Oregon health plan enrollees with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level. This is from the governor's or the Department of Human Services. It says there is compelling evidence, including testimony from advocates and stakeholders, that current premium structure and administrative changes have disproportionately affected the most vulnerable of those that are on in Oregon Health Plan standard, those with incomes from 0 to 10% of the federal poverty level. So eliminating the premiums for this group would be beneficial in ensuring that this public program is serving the poorest of Oregonians. The medical assistance program also recommends eliminating the premiums from those from 0 to 10%, regardless of where the eligibility income limit may be set for the Oregon Health Plan standard, since the policy rationale for this change will still hold even if the income limit is reduced. It goes on to, since it just came before us, it says exemptions from premiums should be restored, and it talks about it's a hardship for vulnerable citizens because many have serious chronic illnesses requiring ongoing care. Many of these individuals don't have permanent addresses. They have a hard time communicating with these patients through the mail because they are finding that is ineffective. So there are a number of reasons why the Office of Medical Assistance feels that this is important to pass and get into legislation. Do you want to go further with these recommendations? Okay. All right. Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd just point out that there are premium assistance programs out there that probably cover the majority of these folks. And one concern I would have is that for those at 11% under this policy, they could claim that this is discriminatory and we could set ourselves up for some action in the future. Seeing how all of these people have access to these premium assistance programs, I'm not sure the ultimate impact is that large, and the liability may be significant downstream.
Okay. Is there any other further discussion? Yes, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson. For what it's worth, I've had to deal with this thing now, starting the e-board. This thing came up in the e-board, and it got sort of nasty there. And we did not choose on two different occasions to go here. If I'm not mistaken, and maybe some of you did served on the Interim Human Resources Committee, I believe you did. I didn't. But the e-board received a letter from the co-chairs of the committee. I believe it was Representative Billy Dalto and Senator Bill Fisher.
Yes.
And they recommended in the strongest possible terms that the e-board at that time take the action which is now before this committee. And we chose not to do it. Some of us nearly lost our lives over it. But I remember that they reviewed this issue on a policy basis, the Interim Committee, Human Resources. And I say I wasn't on the committee, but I remember the letter was several pages, very strongly worded, and they felt that it was a good public policy statement to make. The only reason I'm saying that, Representative Jeff, who said great respect for you, you're much better in this area than I am, but even the Interim Committee, for whatever reasons, they're saying we need to take this action. But again, it's a policy decision. It's been handled on both in the interim basis and even then on the e-board basis and the executive agency basis. So for what it's worth, I just want to enter that record, Chair Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Is there any other further discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Senator
Morissette?
Aye.
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 Motion carries. Who is the author of this bill? We're looking for that.
Well, Shields.
Senator Shields?
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I'd like Senator Shields to carry this bill. Thank you. All right. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 824, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 490. We have Tom Holt, Lorraine Duncan, and Dr. Jim Lacey. Please come forward.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. The School of Pharmacy is at Oregon State University, so I'm happy to be here on OSU Day. You have before you the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 490, and what that will do is reset the age at which pharmacists are allowed to provide immunizations at age 15. It's currently age 18. And I'd like to just briefly recap a couple of things that was talked about in the course of this bill. There's a few things that we know about immunizations in this age group. We know that immunizations generally have a very high return on investment, that they obviously prevent disease, and there's a big high dollar payback in healthcare costs for the vaccine. So we want to reach the most people we can with vaccine. We also know that younger people, once they leave the pediatric arena, tend not to see their physicians as much as we would like them to, or other healthcare providers as much as we would like them to. And we know that there are vaccines in particular that adolescents in this 15 to 18 group should get, perhaps are not getting, or are not getting as much as they should. In particular, young people who are at risk because they have diabetes or asthma or some other chronic condition. There are new vaccines that have just come to the market for meningitis, and hepatitis is becoming an issue amongst the younger group. We also know that pharmacists are the most accessible healthcare providers that there are. There are more than 600 retail pharmacies around the state. You don't have to have an appointment to go in. And so this is one way to increase access to vaccines. Our members reach patients in ways that other providers do not because they are so accessible. talked a lot over the last few weeks about, you know, different age limits and various creative ways to look at arriving at an agreement on the bill. Unfortunately, I don't think we were able to arrive at a total agreement. We came up with 15 because we felt, our members felt, that this would be reaching a core group of people that they felt they could reach, people that they do see in their pharmacies, and that we very much wanted to be able to reach them for some of the vaccines for which the consequences of disease are quite serious. So we see this as a real opportunity to reach people who are not being reached by the healthcare system today. We understand there continues to be some concern about this issue of medical home, and that somehow we will be interfering with the medical home of an adolescent. I'd point out two things. One, unlike any other healthcare provider, when a pharmacist provides a vaccine, there is a report that goes back to the person's primary care physician. No one else does that. In fact, no other state does that. No other state collects the encounter data that we collect on pharmacist immunization practice either. So we see there's an opportunity there for follow-up if the primary care provider so wishes. Pharmacists also do end up counseling people on issues other than the actual product they provide. We're engaged in things like smoking cessation, for example. So there's an opportunity here, and should the bill go forward, we would pledge to work with public health and with our medical colleagues to look at ways that we might take advantage of the new access that would be getting to these adolescents to perhaps counsel them to go in and see their doctor more often when they should, and things of that nature. So with that, I'll close. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, one, I had a couple questions, Madam Chair, but the first one that came up was when you were testifying that the information goes back to their primary care provider. What if they don't have one?
Chair Moss, Anderson, Senator Cruz, if they don't have one, then by rule there is an option of it going to county health. However, the feedback we've had on that is that county health departments generally haven't wanted to get that information. But we'd certainly be willing to look at other things by rule.
Okay. Madam Chair, the reason for that question is, I mean, vaccinations are one thing, immunizations are another universe, and we've been struggling over time to coalesce that data so that we make sure, number one, that kids are getting their matrix, but we're also not duplicating. And so I'm just wondering if we're setting up a disconnect by doing that. And I mean, you know, schools, the information resides in schools. We're trying to get it to transfer with kids. I mean, all those things. So, the vaccine's fine. The immunizations I have concerns about.
Chair Monis, Anderson, Senator Cruz, if I may, for those under age 18, there is a vaccine registry, and we will be required to report to that as well. And that's where you do get that report of everything someone has had recorded in the registry.
Further questions? Yes, Senator George.
Is there any need for a parent to okay this?
Senator Moss, Anderson, Senator George, I don't believe so.
No, age 15, a child, if you want to call a 15-year-old a child, a semi older child can give consent from age 15 and older for any medical procedure.
Middle-aged child.
Middle-aged child, yes.
My 12-year-old already thinks he knows everything. So.
Okay. Dr. Lacey.
Okay. Senator Moss Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lacey. I'm a pediatrician from Salem, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. We too have discussed this bill back and forth many times. We are more than willing to compromise and do the flu vaccine, which drove the initial discussion down to age 15. However, we don't want to budge from our other position, which we think that those vaccines are best done in the doctor's offices. So, but we'd be more than happy to do the flu vaccine down to 15.
Thank you. Ms. Duncan? M. M. Johnston. I didn't see the second name there.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Duncan, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I work with the Department of Human Services in the immunization program. We, like the OMA and the Oregon Pediatric Society, support pharmacists giving immunizations 15 and above for flu only. We do not support it for all vaccines because we think it's essential that they stay in their medical home. Ann Johnson's here from the Adolescent Health Program, and she's compiled some data that she'd like to share with you documenting why the medical home is so important.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Ann Johnson Silverberg. I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I'm also the program and clinical coordinator consultant for the school-based health centers in the Adolescent Health Section of the Office of Family Health and DHS. We're opposing this bill primarily because of the impact that it has once you bring immunizations outside of the medical office. You're talking about a population that already is exhibiting high-risk, vulnerable activities, such as substance abuse, violence, and unprotected sex, and that some of these behaviors that are routinely engaged at this age carry over into adulthood. The other piece is that the group already has a high number of foregone care. When we don't engage them at the opportunity that we have by allowing them to go to another facility, that's a lost opportunity to provide some of the prevention services that were nationally created as a well child check for this age group to provide messages that will help them in their health care as adolescents but also into their adulthood. Research suggests that the well child visit reduces adolescent mortality and morbidity and premature adult mortality. And when we're talking about a well-child visit, what that encompasses and why we're trying to really emphasize that is that it's more than just a physical exam. It's advice on prevention, nutrition, and physical activity based on the other bills that we've talked about today that would very much be in line. The screening and counseling part is key, where you're talking about depression and suicide, tobacco use, alcohol and other drugs, eating disorder, school problems, obesity, contraception, sexual abuse, vision and screening, all key pieces. Plus, you're looking at doing some tests on pap smears, HIV, STDs, cholesterol, and other things. And we also do immunizations as part of those visits. In Oregon, most adolescents are having the preventive care visit once every 2 years. Nationally, it's recommended once every year. But according to the Oregon Healthy Teen data of 11th graders, the age group that you're really talking about, 74% of them have received this service. Immunizations are a key part of the well visit, and it's often the driving force for parents and families to bring their kids in. So we don't want to lose this opportunity. As a public health agency, we support the efforts to enhance immunization rates, but not when it compromises or risks the potential of engaging students and kids in their own health and their longevity of health services.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to provide this information.
Any discussion?
A point of clarification. The question came up before about what's the age, you know, for pediatrics or what's the age of childhood. If you look at federal statute, it's 21. If you look at some other statutes, it's 18. And if you look at age of consent, as you pointed out, it's 15 when your medical records are provided. So it's a shifting target depending upon what service you're going to define. But I forgot to mention that before when I was testifying. So that's not nothing to do with this bill.
Okay. The reason I support this bill is I know that there are a number of families that would love to have their children get the flu shot and do not have a medical home. Usually families who do have a medical home will go, or they'll go to the county health department, et cetera. But this is a matter of access, if you will, convenience, and it would be, I don't know how many pharmacies would participate in this, but most of them would want to do it for flu rather than giving a tetanus shot or a measles, mumps, or rubella shot. But there are occasions when you have a child who wants to go into college and doesn't have the MMR or doesn't have a record and wants to go in and give an MMR. I don't know if a physician, but this would allow that college student to go in and get an MMR or a tetanus to get into college or the community college, wherever they are at, especially if they are out of state and they're not in their own hometown and they need it to get into class. So it's just a matter of convenience that I was looking at this bill. But I want to don't want to go into work session until I know the will of this committee. So can we have any further? Can we stand at ease for just a minute? I'm going out on a limb on this. I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 490. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 490.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment, Senate Bill 490.
All right. Senator Cruz has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 490. I think that the consensus I got from the committee members, there are a couple who are not comfortable with this bill. There are the majority that are willing for the bill to pass, and I think that it would be nice to get it to the floor, and the major concerns, particularly with the, it's basically flu vaccine, and that could maybe be addressed over in the House when it gets over there, if so be it. But with that, any other further? Yes, Senator Courtney.
Okay. I'm nervous about the bill because when a doctor sits and testifies that the way he did, that concerns me. I'm taken by the chair's desire for access. I mean, access is important. So I'm getting the signal from her. She doesn't need my vote, so I'm going to be a no in committee at this time. I was just concerned by what was put on the record about, you heard the testimony about the issue of making sure an individual who's providing the service has the ability to provide it, the knowledge, etc. That's all. That's what I'm concerned about this time. So I just can't be a yes now. But you know that, Chairman. I let you know that.
Yes. Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I have concerns, too, and I support the program. It was in 99 it came out of my committee, and it's been highly successful for flu vaccinations, and I am concerned about the scope. I truly am, and I guess the reason I'm willing to move the bill at this point in time, I would like to see, especially for flu vaccines, I would like to see access expanded, but knowing the time frame we're under here for Senate bills on this side, I guess we, you know, we're to the point in the session where we're going to have to trust that further work can be done on the House side. And Clary, then it comes back, Madam Chair, to you for concurrence. But I am supporting moving this bill with the full expectation that further work will be done on the bill once it gets to the House.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Well, I'd like to know where Senator Courtney got the idea that she didn't need his vote. I thought she didn't need my vote.
I think she's all right if she wouldn't be taking this gamble.
I will support the bill, but with the idea that there will be some changes.
Yes. All right. Okay. The -1s have, yes, Senator Cruz moved the -1s to Senate Bill 490.
Uh-huh. Madam Chair, before Senator George has his
any discussion on the -1s?
No, not on the -1.
Okay, let me move the bill then, Madam Chair. Okay. I'll move the Senate Bill 490 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved that Senate Bill 490 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Just really quickly, I shared that with the Senate President. That as I read back through on the background of the bill and from our major summary, and I looked at what is required. In other words, this has to be a person who is currently practicing as a pharmacist administering this. And if you see the bullet points down here at the bottom and the things that they have to go through, and the very fact that was pointed out that 21 years of age is, in fact, the level at the federal level, if I understood that right,
yes.
We allow 18, but 15 is actually a point in which decisions are made by young people relative to health care. With that in mind, with their experience and with that decision making enabled, I'm going to support this.
All right. Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chairman Maud Sanderson?
Aye. Motion passes. Should you or I carry
it? You carry it.
Okay.
you're more.
I will carry the bill. All right. I will now close the work session on Senate Bill 490, and I'm going to open a work session. A public hearing on Senate Bill 618, and Diane Garrett and Amelia Smythe. Yes, and please, will you explain what we have here?
Thank you, Chair. And this bill does have a minimal fiscal impact. I just received the information just before the hearing started, so make that notation on your summary. We did hear this bill earlier on the 30th of March. Basically requires employers to be accommodating to employees who are breastfeeding or express milking for a child. There are the Dash 1 amendments enclosed in your packet, and there is an engrossed version of the amendments within your pack as well. Basically, what it does is allow the employer to make reasonable accommodation to include a child care facility in close proximity. It does remove the prohibitions of the employer cannot discharge, demote, or suspend or discriminate against an employee. Also removes allowing the employee to file a complaint with the Bureau of Labor and Industries or BOLI and to seek compensatory damages up to $1,000. It does change the size of the employer who this applies to from 8 to 25 or more. And then also does only apply to employers who have an employee who has a child up to age 18 months. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Diane Garrett, Chair and members of the committee. I'm with Nursing Mothers Council. We just want to underscore what you are making as a priority to get into statute. We want to underscore that, the importance of getting time allowed and space allowed for women to breastfeed or express milk, so we understand and are amenable to the changes that have been made, and just want to clarify line 5 and 6 where ORS 653 is mentioned.
Is this on the amendment or the...
This is on the bill, the printed bill, where it says that this be made part of ORS 653.010. We just want to clarify what the intent of the chair was on that by leaving that in, or is that going to be clarified in some way? Bureau of Labor and Industries has indicated there may still be some jurisdiction that they have under that.
Okay, and it's my understanding that ORS 653.010, if we could get that, it deals with the office, with the Bureau of Labor Management, and that should have been taken out by Legislative Council. And so, because what we have done with this amendment is to remove the civil penalty on any of the businesses, and so
you could carry this over till Friday and get an amendment to
that. What we will then do is just carry this over till Friday to make sure that is removed, because I don't really want to send anything out that's going to cause complications. Is that all right with the committee here? All right. Great. Any further comments then?
No. Thank you.
Any other people to testify? All right. Thank you. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 618, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 936. Mr. Pafori.
You're into the notification, I guess. You've changed. Everybody, congratulations.
No, I can go along with it. I just said it's true.
I see. I'm learning more and more about you sitting next to me than I ever would have.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here today representing the Oregon Acupuncture Association. If you would please address the amendments, dash one amendments, rather than the bill.
One and not dash two?
Excuse me, dash two, I'm sorry.
Dash two?
Dash two. Are there other dash twos?
There are only dash twos in my packet.
I
We have the dash one.
I have dash twos. What are they?
Well, the one on right.
Oh, I don't.
I'm testifying on two bills at the same time. One has one amendment, and one has two. I think there's only one amendment to this bill, Madam Chair.
Well, then it's dash one, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then you said dash two.
I was thinking about the other bill in the other committee.
Can we get, I think he's talking dash one, or do you have dash two?
I have the dash twos, and I'd like him to take, could you come up and take a look at these? Because they're very similar to yours. It's just some rewording. The differences are at the top. And here's the dash one.
Same bill?
My confusion is
this you're going to hand me something last. It's
I think so.
936.
936?
Yes, we are doing that. Do you have any handouts?
Madam Chair, I assume that there are some technical amendments I haven't seen between dash two, 1 and 2. The policy would be exactly the same. The operative words at the bottom.
What's the difference? Well, at the very beginning. The way I look at it really quick, because I just am looking at these amendments right now, is it's your wording that's put in. It's just at the very top, and they have changed some wording. So we'll get that clarified.
Okay, thank you.
It's creating new provisions, so they just added after the related.
That's what I thought.
That's all they did.
Yeah.
Well, all right, Madam Chair.
Deleting lines.
If I may, Stephen Gafori, representing the Oregon Acupuncture Association.
So that does eliminate.
Yeah.
That.
So we'll. Yeah, we can. Go ahead. This is a public hearing
okay,
only.
Thank
right.
you. The acupuncture profession is regulated by the and licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners. We do not have our own licensing board. We have a situation where we have a lot of continuing education that goes on. A lot of other states and other foreign countries do not license acupuncturists. So when a person comes from another state and they're in the state of Oregon for the purpose of presenting a continuing education program, they cannot actually do acupuncture as part of that education program because they're unlicensed. All this bill does is gives the Board of Medical Examiners the authority to exempt those people temporarily from the licensing statutes under rules that they have already adopted. And you already have a letter from Kathleen Haley from the Board of Medical Examiners supporting this bill.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah. To
yes.
clarify.
Yes.
And thank you, sir. We will. The letter from the Board of Medical Examiners supports the bill with the dash one amendments. We will have to clarify if the dash twos are the pertinent amendments that they supported, just for the record.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, could you again explain again the problem that we're having here and why we need this legislation?
The problem is that people come from out of state to the state of Oregon to provide educational programs on acupuncture. They are not licensed in Oregon if they don't live in Oregon. And if they are, during their presentation, want to do acupuncture, want to stick needles in people's bodies, that's against the law in Oregon. So what this says, notwithstanding the law saying you have to be licensed acupuncturist in order to practice acupuncture, if a person is coming here for a short-term educational program under limited circumstances, they can practice acupuncture without being licensed by the state under rules of the board. And the board rules are very specific about getting advance approval and having someone in the room who isn't licensed acupuncturist. There's quite detailed rules about how this is done to safeguard public health.
Excellent. Okay, any other further questions? Again, this then is a bill. There's no one else to testify, correct? Yeah. And you do have a letter, is that right? In
Board
your
of yes,
folder
ma'am.
From the Board of Medical Examiners.
Madam Chair, the difference between the original bill and the dash one or two is because of suggestions that came from the Board of Medical Examiners. We work very closely with them on all matters of policy.
Okay. Mr. Bacobian, would you then check with the Board of Medical Examiners regarding the dash twos? And also I then will like to carry this bill over till our Friday's meeting in Bend. You certainly don't need to be there. We'll have a possible work session then in Bend. All right?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think the biggest difference between the ones and twos is the twos delete the bill. And the ones don't.
Yeah, we'll just need to take a closer look at it. All right. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 936 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 962. Let me see. 936. Yes, and Mr. Bacobian, will you explain what we have?
Yes, thank you, Chair. We did hear this on the 23rd of March. Basically, prohibits octopentin and as well as DECA BDEs, and it requires the Department of Human Services to do a report on these at a certain juncture. We do have the Dash 5 amendments and Dash 6 amendments in your packet. I only had the opportunity to summarize the Dash 5 amendments. If you look at the engrossed version in your packet, it does include both Dash 5 and Dash 6s. What this basically does is eliminate the DECA BDE provisions from the bill. It does delete several pages which talk to the DECA, and then as you get to page, let me get there, 6 of your engrossed version, it does insert the language from the Dash 6s, which is in the back of your packet, which should be the last set of amendments, and that is language that basically includes in that section used products for replacement parts, and we do have somebody to testify on that if necessary.
Okay, I have a question, Mr. Bacobian, on the Dash 6s. The Dash 5s would eliminate Section 4, and in the Dash 6s, Section 4 is included. So how does that happen when you have two amendments, even though the lines that are wanting to be incorporated are not in the section that was deleted?
Right. And these, thank you, Chair. These would be melded. Yes, the original Dash 5 did eliminate the Dash or the Section 4, as I read it. But since there's a new ORS addressed, it did add back a Section 4 to the bill. So it just kind of picks up where the Dash 5 eliminated Section 4. The Dash 6 is put in different Section 4 back in.
So this isn't the same Section 4 that's in the bill?
To my knowledge, no.
Yes, it is.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So we'll have to get this.
That's the Section 4 is current law.
But we're going to delete it in the Dash 5.
You delete it from the bill, you don't delete it from current law, I don't believe.
Yeah.
Mainly what's involved here is 6 does not presume 5. That's what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? That's why it appears that way.
Right.
5 does what it does, and 6 does what it does. And they both do what they do to the law, and they do not conflict with each other to print it up. But 6 cannot show 5 because 5 has necessarily happened. So I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Maybe. Okay.
And I'd also point out, Madam Chair, we still have the Dash 1 amendments.
Yes, and we still have the Dash 1. Do you want to explain the Dash 1?
These are Senator Cruz's amendments. I think you have maybe the...
You need more copies?
Yes.
Okay, do you want to describe what they do?
Basically, I would say the difference between the ones and the fives are the ones basically delete all reference to DECA from the bill, and the fives talk about the creation of a report and studying a report and on what else is out there, and that's basically it.
Well, both the Dash 1s and the Dash 5s delete DECA from the bill, except the Dash 5s puts in that if a report is prepared, it will be prepared under this bill by DHS to review the available research that is going on DECA brominated diphenyl, and to look at that, because that is a chemical that is posing potential harm to public health and the environment, and that then they shall recommend to the legislature to prohibit the sale of the products if there are any research that comes out that is going to show that it is very toxic to the public health and to the environment. So okay. That's the difference.
And I'm sure I'll discuss that when we're going to work session.
All right. Okay, Matt Blevins and Rhett Lawrence and Catherine Thomason might as well all come up.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. Just want to speak to a couple of the different issues. First, obviously there continues to be some discussion around this bill and the issues that are contained in that. We wanted to just revisit a couple of those things, not very much in depth, but again, I think there's some concern about whether or not there's conclusive evidence around the risk of DECA in particular. We continue to feel pretty strongly that there is evidence that's sufficient to warrant taking proactive actions to reduce the risk that we're seeing here in Oregon. There's also concern about whether or not the alternatives that are available to replace DECA pose a greater risk. We continue to feel that there's a lot of evidence that there are alternatives out there that do not pose a greater risk that can be used in place of those, and that even though other jurisdictions have not banned DECA at this point, we continue to want to point out that a number of jurisdictions, including Washington State and Maine, are intending to ban those products here in the near future. And so we would encourage the committee to take all those things into consideration. We feel very strongly that any kind of move to completely disregard dealing with DECA in this bill, as highlighted in the Dash 1s and then presumably in the Dash 6, although I haven't seen the Dash 6, so I'm just presuming that's what they say, would not be advisable at this point. At this point, we would not oppose the Dash 5s, but we're not going to support those. We have concerns about the fact that it does not set up as much of a comprehensive effect or attempt to deal and address the risks that we see posed by DECA at this point in Oregon. So we appreciate the committee continuing to look at this issue and trying to work with us to move this through the process, and we continue to hope that we can move this through the Senate and continue to work on it in the House to come to a positive resolution on this.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Catherine Thomason. I'm a physician with Physicians for Social Responsibility. Thank you for allowing me to speak again on this. On behalf of Physicians for Social Responsibility and over 1,000 members in Oregon, we recommend that the amendments not be passed and that DECA be included in the bill for several reasons. The first is that DECA levels are rising. When we know now, over the last 2 years, how much better to actually do the assays for DECA. DECA levels are rising, in particularly at the top of the food chain. It's in cheese, it's in ducks, it's in fish, it's in farm salmon much more than wild salmon. And so we're now finding DECA when we know now how to look for it. In addition, we show that the DECA is absorbed into humans and that it is taken up into the brain. The second major point is that whether or not DECA breaks down both in the environment and in humans and other species into brominated chemicals, the PBDEs, that we already know are toxic and that are being removed from the market, the pentas, hexas, octas, and so on, that have been better studied than the DECA. And there are numerous studies in trout, carp, mice, and rats that are fed solely DECA in controlled environments, and that shows that it does absorb and that there are DECA levels, and that in one particular study in carp, that the levels of the penta in the carp continue to rise for 10 days after they stop feeding at DECA. So that we do know that it is breaking down in the bodies, in the environment, to levels, to products that are known to be harmful, that we are banning with this particular bill. that's the second major point. The third major point is that we know in and of itself DECA is problematic, and there are several studies in mice. Fortunately, there aren't studies in humans because the levels in humans are still at 1/10 to 1/100, depending on where you look, that would potentially cause harm if we use a PCB model. And we know that PCBs at those levels cause IQ effects, psychomotor retardation, behavioral problems, anywhere from birth all the way through teens, and that using the same models, this chemical seems to work in the same ways in the developing brains. There are other alternatives, as the main report has, I think, laid out very well. Some of the alternatives are that we don't need to use flame retardants because we could use different products. The new plastics that are being created don't even need flame retardants and still meet the same standards. The fact that you have the Firefighters Association supporting this bill, including the DECA component, indicates that there are alternatives and that they, in fact, think the alternatives are safer to their own health when they're fighting fires, because these brominated flame retardants are toxic when they're burned to the people who are trying to fight the fire. The main report does recommend, although they state that because of the way the bill was laid up, they aren't going to take it up until 2008, but they do recommend that it be taken up and that DECA be banned. And, of course, Washington does as well. So thank you again for allowing me to comment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm an environmental advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And on behalf of the nearly 30,000 members we have around the state, I wanted to get up here and express our concerns. We do believe that the science surrounding DECA is solid, that we, you know, it's conclusive. We have a need to take action on doing something with DECA now. And, you know, for the reasons that Matt and Catherine have already explicated, we would also oppose or would not be able to support any amendment to this bill that did not leave DECA in the mix and did not address DECA in some fashion. So we would certainly express our concerns and urge you to retain DECA in the bill, and we will not be able to support the -1 or -5 amendments and haven't seen the -6s yet. So.
Okay. Discussion. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Can any of you give me some scientific reports of alternatives and how they compare to DECA? I've never seen any. Or are we just assuming that the other things must be better?
Chairman Senderson, Senator Cruz, I can actually provide some of these that have been provided by the Clean Production Action. I can hand this out to you that can sort of outline some of those different products that are available, how they compare to DECA, et cetera, and we can walk through those if you want to, but I can also just provide those.
I have spent more time on this bill than any other bill whole session, because I think it's a very, very important issue, and I did not want to make a decision that was going to adversely affect Oregon, and yet I wanted to be very cautious about the potential public health problems that might have. And I have looked at the studies that Mr. Blevins and Ms. Thomason have given very, very detailed, and just to let you know, penta and octa are toxic. It's proven. And in looking at those studies, 2 milligrams per kilogram would adversely affect rodents that they were using in the studies. When they did DECA, they had up to 1,500 to 2,500 milligrams per kilogram before they started seeing cancerous effects. You know, 1,500 to 2,500 compared to 2 per kilogram compared to 2 milligrams per kilogram. There's a huge difference. Also, 20 milligrams per kilogram was used. The studies showed 20 milligrams per kilogram of DECA, they were starting to see some effects. Again, this is a huge amount of chemical to get an effect. I used to do scientific, I used to be in cancer research, so this is why these studies are very important to me. And I would, through all of those studies, again, nothing is yet conclusive. And the state of Washington is coming out with a report in December of 2005 because they are looking at this, and I think that we will definitely want to look at those studies. The European Union has been also studying this and looking at it. They did take DECA off of their at-risk table for the time being because they felt the studies weren't conclusive enough. So that's why I felt it was so necessary to have these amendments come in, because we still, I know our proponents say there's hard evidence. There isn't hard evidence yet. And so I just needed to share that I have taken this personally. I have looked at the studies. I have read the studies, and I'm still want to take a precautionary approach to not banning DECA at this point in time. Any other further discussion? Is there anyone else here to testify?
No.
Okay. Do you need to explain the dash sixes? It's pretty straightforward on the dash sixes. Does Mr. Marquis want to give a rebuttal?
No rebuttal on the science, Madam Chair, but I would like to explain the difference.
Mr. Cosgrove, will you explain the Dash 6 amendments, and then Mr. Marquis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The bill as written and would be, under any of these amendments, exempt used products. And the Dash 6s address a product that isn't really quite used, although you might consider it used. In the automobile industry, we build cars and we build the replacement parts for those cars at the same time, and obviously those cars stay around for a number of years. The Dash 6s exempt parts that were manufactured prior, replacement parts for products that were manufactured prior to the effective date, so it's akin to the used parts exemption. I'd point out there's just one technical problem with the Dash 6s, which I think could be remedied in one of three ways. My submission list at council was just lines 1 through 6 of the Dash 6, because I presumed that either the 1s or the 5s would take out the sections relating with DECA. They've put back in section 4, so that can be remedied by either moving just lines 1 through 6 of the Dash 6, which solves my issue without confusing the other parts of the bill, or by ensuring that the instructions of the committee are clear to legislative council that if you move the 1s and or the 5s, that they take precedence over the 6s so that you don't add back in something you just amended out. The third way is you could have a new amendment drafted, but I'm sorry it wasn't drafted as I expected it to be.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I we're going to be able to come back and do a work session at some point, but I would rather have the amendments done right so we know for sure what's going on. So if there's a problem with the Dash 6, even if it's a word or two, I don't want to mess with that.
What we could do is just move the Dash 5s, and then you take care of that over in the House. Pardon? I thought we took care of that. Let's stand at ease just for a minute. The person who drafted the bill is sick, is not here.
Yes.
And so what I am going to do is carry this over to Friday in Bend, and that way we can take care of this merge, et cetera, between now and Friday. But do you have any other?
I just wanted to clarify the difference between the Dash 1s and the Dash 5s, because I think
yes, go ahead.
Confusion, and I, again, I want to thank the chair for her attentiveness to this issue. I wanted to point out that the Dash 1s do not in any way obviate the need, don't eliminate sub 2 of section 9 on page 8 of the bill. And the bill has
identify yourself, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jim Marquis, representing the American Chemistry Council. Thank you. Sub 2 of the bill says that the Department of Human Services shall submit a report in January of each even-numbered year to the appropriate interim committee with jurisdiction over natural resources, a summary review of relevant new studies on brominated flame retardants and recent findings and rulings by the United States Environmental Protection Agency and the European Union, recommendations regarding restrictions, etc. All of that remains in the bill, so that in the dash ones, so that the dash ones did not eliminate that language. The DHS would still do this study. The only thing we added was an opportunity for public comment at DHS on their findings. And we think that's appropriate, and we think that DHS should do that kind of a study. The only difference between the dash fives and the dash ones, then, is this language that is added that says if a report prepared pursuant to sub 2 of this section finds a nationally available alternative that seems to be less harmful than DECA, then they shall recommend to the legislature that DECA be banned. Well, our problem with that language is that there already is there are alternatives out there that are used. My clients make DECA and the alternatives. I think it would be a judgment call on the part of DHS as to which is safer. DECA probably is more fully studied presently than most of the alternatives, so we might just not know what is safer. And I think it's much cleaner to adopt the dash ones, and the dash five seems to kind of confuse the issue with respect to the report. So with all due respect to the chair, with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hendricks. We'll take care of this with the drafter. We'll be down to see you shortly. Okay. With that, we are going to carry this over to Friday in Bend. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 962. And colleagues, we will have a meeting in Bend, and from what I hear, Senator Jordan, Senator Cruz will not be there. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, if I could speak to that, you have taken several bills on today's agenda that are fairly significant bills and moved them to Friday when, due to other obligations, neither Senator George and I are going to be there, and I have a strong objection to bills of this magnitude being considered without the full committee.
I know. We're under a time constraint. This was on the agenda. I had planned to pass two of the bills. There's just two that we're carrying over. Is that correct? And they're well vented, and we do have a timeline, so we will be moving forward and dealing with these bills on Friday.
Well, Madam Chair, as you said yourself, you've spent a great deal of time on a couple of these bills, and they are significant. I would suggest that maybe a better approach might be to petition the President for one-day extension to have these bills vetted before the full committee.
Yes, and I take that into account, but I am going to be hearing them on Friday. With that, the meeting is adjourned.